Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners, or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard They Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Transcription for this podcast is brought to you by HarperTranscriptions.com. If you have any transcription needs, please head on over to our website. And if you mention this podcast, They Had to Go Out, your first transcription will be for free. Stay salty, my friends.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of They Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you guys for joining us. Thanks for continuing to tune in, continuing to listen, and continuing to get these stories of Coast Guard veterans out there. Really appreciate all your support.
Yeah, everybody, thanks for being here. If it's your first time being here, we're really glad you found us. Check us out on Instagram, Twitter, any social media outlets that you can think of. And remember to subscribe and give us a five-star review on there, please.
Hey guys, we got a special one for you today. It's not often that we get Coast Guard, you know, designated celebrities, I would say, on the line. But who we've got today just wrote a book. That's kind of where we saw his name come back up in recent memory. He made a trip out to Training Center Yorktown and did a meet and greet with the Chief's Mess here, and we were lucky enough to find his phone number and be able to give him a call and get him on the line. And who we've got is former Master Chief Petty Officer of the Coast Guard, Skip Bowen. Joined the Coast Guard back in 1978, Recruit Company Uniform 100. Served his nation for a full 32 years. Certified as both an officer in charge ashore and afloat. Also did a few tours as a Command Master Chief. And rounded out his career as the Master Chief Petty Officer of the Coast Guard. And with that, Master Chief, welcome.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having this podcast. I think it's really great. I had not known that you guys were doing this, and Vince Patton is the lead on as far as my set, which is the senior enlisted crew for the Coast Guard Museum. I think that's a great thing to do these podcasts, and I reviewed several of them. It's awesome capturing all these folks' memories, and most of them were peers of mine, so I was pretty excited to find that on the web.
That's awesome.
Yeah, thanks. We appreciate that, Master Chief. We have a lot of fun doing it, for sure.
Yeah, I learn a lot, for sure. Yeah, I can't wait to see what we learn from this one.
Yeah, I'm...
with that, Master Chief, I'm going to let Bill go ahead and ask you the question.
And I'm looking forward to the answer on this one. So, Master Chief, what's your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
I got a lot of stories. I was one of those guys. I wasn't like Vince Patton in boot camp where I'm doing push-ups and I suddenly had this epiphany that I'm going to be the Master Chief of the Coast Guard. You know, I was somebody that kind of just went through a career. I was just really wanting to focus on boats and somehow found my way to that. But it was pure. I mean, I got in a lot of actually pretty difficult situations, somehow got out of them. when with no loss of life, thank God. And we, you know, we made it on through. But I'll tell you, the probably it's particularly early in my career. I'm not sure I used a lot of risk management, no risk management philosophy. That's for sure. So I don't know. I to be honest with you, there's like a zillion things I could talk about. But I'll talk about two things that aren't in the book. You know, in the book, which is called Breaching the Summit, and we're actually between publishers right now, but Casemate Publishing, which is a really large military publisher, is going to republish this book this coming October. And this was written by five other of my peers from the senior enlisted ranks, former Master Chief of the Navy, Rick West, former Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps, Mike Barrett, former Sergeant Major of the Army, Ken Preston, former National Guard Senior Enlisted Advisor, Denise Jelinski Hall, and former Chief Master Sergeant of the Air Force, Jim Roy. And I served with all these folks, and we got together and decided to write a book.
With you, you leading the way, right, Master Chief? Is that, I mean, because the Coast Guard leads the way in that whole
The Navy
group,
can't fire.
Well, I would Coast say Guard, that, so. You know, these are all type A personalities. I'm not sure how much I left away. I will say I get stuck with a lot of the management things with this deal. I'll tell you that. I'm not sure about that.
The bosun mate and the management section. Who screwed that up? Yeah, right? What were they thinking?
You know, that was dreamed up by Rick West, I think, because anyway. So anyway, so we all wrote this book, and it's their leadership lessons gleaned from our experiences. But I'm going to use just two what I think are really great sea stories that aren't in the book, because like I said, I got a zillion of them. So probably around 1986, late 1986, I was the BM-1 on the Farallon, which is was the first of the 110s that were built by Bollinger Shipyard, so actually employed by right now. And so Farallon, we were south of Cuba, and we'd gotten this drug boat. It was full of marijuana. It was a sailboat. It was probably about 45 feet long, pretty big sailboat. I found out later it must have had lead in the keel. But, I mean, we're towing this sailboat along, loaded with marijuana. We got three of the three prisoners up on the O-1 deck. And, you know, as we're towing it, in the early days of the 110s, the Class A 110s really clutched in at a high rate of speed. Your listeners will understand this. I mean, one engine, within seconds, you're going 9 knots. Two engines, 12 knots. So it was really hard to tow things like a sailboat slow enough to not do damage. And we were just, it was a brand new boat, still learning it, and there had been several sinkings. That's just a boat that not only we, but our fellow 110s out of Miami had been towing, and we were just learning about these boats. Actually, Farallon had not sunk one. But anyway, we had this sailboat in tow, loaded with marijuana, and you know, it's getting dark, and I'm looking. I've got the watch. I've got the 8 to 12s, and me and the BM-2 are on the bridge, and I'm looking at it with binoculars, and I'm thinking, that's looking low in the water. So I called the CO, who I won't name, and he says, don't worry about it. Boats will look at it in the morning. And so, you know, like I had the 4 to 8. Wait a minute. I had the 4 to 8 watch. So I had the 4 to 8 in the morning, late dawn. I look out there, and it's really low in the water now. So I said to the BM-2, watch, we're about to go into emergency mode here. So I called the CO and I said, hey, I think that boat back there is sinking. And he rushes to the bridge and, oh, you know, we got the SAR alarm going off. You know, we're getting ready to launch the small boat. We're going back there. And basically we're towing this thing at like 9 knots with one engine. And it probably way faster than that this thing should be towed anyway. And anyway, it's way low in the water. By the time we can launch the boat underway, under tow, you know, those boats we launched off the deck into the water. It was a 17-foot Avon, one of those old, before they had Zodiacs. And we went back there. And,
you know what's funny, Master Chief, is like you kind of gloss over like launching that boat while in tow.
At 9 knots, I mean, towing another boat. Yeah.
If nobody's seen a 110 small boat evolution, like you need to Google that thing or YouTube it or whatever and watch that, because that's a pretty sketchy deal, I think. People just getting dragged all across the deck. And I love it.
Well, you also got to realize that the seas were getting up about this time. It'd been calm that night.
There we go. Now it's a real sea story. Yeah, I like it. Good.
So we go back here, and the freaking boat is Sorry for about my French there, but the boat is almost level with the water. You know, and nowadays, these young coasties, I mean, they're trained to kind of evaluate what's the safest way to do this. But we go charging on there. Two of our guys are setting up a pump in the stern, and I go running up to the bridge, and I'm seeing right away the, being back there, you could really see that the Farallon pulling that boat forward was sinking us. So we had these little radios, and I'm sitting there calling them, trying to tell them to, drop the tow, drop the tow. Nobody's like answering. So I grab my knife and I start hacking through the tow line, which was a substantial tow line. It was like a 4-inch line. And so I'm doing that, and that boat all of a sudden just goes up and to the left and just capsizes. I mean, the whole boat just comes down at a 90-degree angle. And the guys in the crewmen that were in the back of the vessel went into the water back there away from any gear. But I was right there in the bow, and I got caught. I was wearing a rain slicker and, of course, an old Mustang Type 3, which was a flotation vest only. And, of course, my radio gear and stuff like that. And I went right in the water beside the boat, and some gear caught the back of my slicker and drug me down. And I mean, I was going down. I couldn't get loose. I'm flailing with my arms. And I really didn't think at that moment that I was under that much stress, but I'll tell you why I know I was later. But this is dragging me down, and I'm thinking, oh, this might be it, and because I couldn't get loose. But suddenly, whatever was holding me from the back of that rain slicker let loose whatever gear was holding me, and I came popping to the surface just at the top of the mast. We was coming down into the water, and it had a crossbar at the top. And the 17-foot outboard small boat was coming in to try to see where I'd gone, because they saw me go down. And that side of that sidebar on that mast caught the back of that RHI and flipped it. Well, it didn't flip it, but, it popped it up. So one of the sponsons, these weren't like they are today with a bunch of flotation in these sponsons. These were air-filled sponsons. It's like one of the largest sides is losing air. You know, they drug me aboard. He'd already picked up the other two. And we go back to the boat, and I'm sitting there. I remember I was holding my hand over the sponson, and the air's just coming out of it. We got up along the
trying to stop the bleed?
Right. Trying, but got it up alongside the 110, got it hooked up. I got up on, to be honest with you, We later it was reported that we were laughing, and right. We were. It was like, if you're ever that close to death, it's like, if you don't die, it's like a friggin' rush.
Oh yeah.
We were really glad to be alive. I was glad to be alive. So I got on deck. I was laughing and shouting, and we got that small boat out there. But see, those three smugglers were up on that 01 deck, and so this is the rest of the story. The Miami Herald, like a month later, did a story on the multiple Coast Guard sinkings, and it was like this conspiracy that we were down there sinking these boats. And on this particular one, they didn't use our names or anything except for the name of the vessel, but they, in the Miami Herald, it honestly said that we were cheering when we got on deck for a sinking well done. I gotta tell you, I almost died over that boat, and it wasn't cheering because of that. We were just glad to escape. No risk management, no nothing.
That's all. Hey, question for you, Master Chief. Did you hang on to your knife when the boat flipped?
No, man. That thing.
Yeah, I was just curious. I just wanted to see. Yeah.
When I went in the water, there was, it just happened. It was like just instantaneous. And I'm going down, and like I lost my glasses. I clenched. That's why I know I was under stress. I clenched down so hard on my teeth that I busted a back molar.
Ooh.
And, all my gear was completely ruined, but I wasn't expecting to take a swim.
Right.
But interesting time.
For
and
sure.
I got another one, and then we can just discuss things if you'd like. So this is also no leadership lessons associated with these things. Just dumb luck that we didn't get screwed up. So, again, a lot of my career, things just happened, and You know, fortunately, there was nobody hurt or no loss of life. But so I'm on the Point Arena. I probably would have got pretty. Actually, I think I'm not so sure I didn't get some low marks on safety once in a while. I can remember the second CO of the Farallon, not the first one that I just was talking about, because he didn't use no risk management at all. But I remember being outside the lifeline on that thing, doing up a tow, and I hear this yellow, "Going, what in the hell are you doing?" You know, I mean, it's like I'm trying to get this line rigged, and I guess, you know, I mean, I am supposed to ask permission before I do something. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. So let's fast forward just a couple of years. I'm on the Point Arena, and this is actually in a book called Mayday, Mayday, written long ago by some guy. His name was Samuel Schreiner. But anyway,
was he on the boat, or was he just a third party?
No, he was just a historian that put together a bunch of stories about Coast Guard rescues back then.
I got you. You know, it's going to be a good one, though. If a historian had to look it up and put it in a book, it's going to be a good one.
Right.
So it's December 23rd, 1989. I'm actually newly married, and my wife wasn't really. She didn't really understand this whole Coast Guard thing. But I noted we were on like a B-2 response, which means you have to get underway within 2 hours. This is an 82-foot patrol craft, which was the predecessor to the 87s. It's blowing a gale out there. We're talking about 50-knot winds, and it's a blizzard-type conditions. It's snowing. It's icing. It's really, really cold. This was in the Norfolk area in the Chesapeake Bay. So I was the executive petty officer of the 82. The CO was actually, he's a retired Coast Guard captain named Joe Ray, really great guy. He could run an 82 just as good as any Master Chief I ever met.
Was he?
Including
me.
I mean, that guy really had some talent.
He was a JG CO?
Yeah, he was a JG CO, and we became lifelong friends. I still do a lot with him. He's with me on the board for the Association for Rescue at Sea. In fact, he relieved me as president this last year. But anyway, since it's December 23rd, 1989, we're getting ready for Christmas, right? And so, I mean, it's blowing a blizzard, and I get this call, and we all go in. And the small boat at Little Creek Station couldn't get out because it was past their operating parameters. But again, you know, it was the early days of risk management even then, and like the station had risk, operating parameters, but 82s, clearly did not. And I mean, this wasn't past the operating parameter for an 82, but it was really pushing it when you're going to put a 13-foot small boat over the side.
Right. Past the good idea parameters.
Yeah.
So it's in the Chesapeake Bay. It's blowing 50 miles an hour. It's a blizzard. So visibility, I mean, the snow's coming at you sideways. I'd never really been north. This was my first time north of the 7th District. And in those kind of conditions, I'd never seen before. I mean, it was like everything's icing. It was freaking unbelievable to me, which was a Florida guy that grew up in Florida. But so
I can just picture your face. Like, how do you guys live like this?
this is about a 50-foot sailboat that, for whatever reason, was coming across the Chesapeake Bay. And I forget the name of the sailboat, but had two people on it, a male elderly person and a female elderly person. And, I mean, this was a known storm. Why they were coming across there, I don't know, but they were. And they had tried to anchor up, but their anchor just kept dragging, and they were heading towards the beach. And under those conditions, I mean, these were heavy breakers, even on the beach in Little Creek. It was really blowing up a storm. And we got out there. Well, first we tried to take them in tow, and we passed a tow line, and I mean, you know, it was tough even getting the crew out there safely and getting this tow line across. But the each time we tried, the male on board, he was too weak to pull it across. He couldn't get it across. So then their anchor fetched up, and we thought, well, maybe we'll have better luck in daylight because it was only maybe 2 hours to daylight. It was like 4 a.m. in the morning. And so we go into Little Creek, and we're tying up. And like I said, that it was blowing a gale, but that Joe Ray, he pulled back. I can remember that night. He pulled into that pier at Little Creek, and he tied it up really good. And just as we were getting the last line on, the sailboat starts yelling, "Mayday, mayday, we're dragging toward the beach again." So we go back out there, and now we know we can't get the line over. So the only recourse is to try to get these two people off, and the only small boat we have is this 13-foot. And again, it was a rigid hull inflatable, no flotation in it, just a sponge in these 13-foot. That was an Avon too. The Avons were popular back in those days. I think Zodiacs kind of took them over later, but this was an Avon, 13 feet long. So I asked the crew on the Point Arena. I said, "Hey, I'm getting in that small boat. Who's going to go with me?" And I think the entire crew took a step back, except the cook. And this guy named Jason, the cook, his name was Jason Leonard. He was a good guy, and he says, "Okay, well, we're going to go do this." And you always started those boats up on deck before you tried to get them in the water. And again, seas are like 10 to 12 feet, very steep, okay? So it's not like a 10 to 12 foot sea out in the Pacific, which might be seen not that large. This is like really steep because it's in this very shallow Chesapeake Bay. Wind's blowing about 50, coming sideways. We get that small boat, we get it ready to go, get it to the side, get in it, let it down, and I get it running. And we move away from the side of the 82, and the engine conks out. And later we found out that the was so cold, there was water in the gas line, and it froze. Mm-hmm. So no gas was getting to that engine, and there was no way to do any, maintenance on it or adjustments at that moment anyway. I mean, I'm a bosun mate, and I know that this is bad. I'm going toward the beach in this tiny 13-foot seat. I'm looking up at waves that are like, higher than the length of the boat. And we're going, I forgot about the sailboat because we're going to the beach too.
Yeah, you're in your own case now.
It looked mountainous from there, let me tell you. Well, Jason Leonard, I got to say, the cook kept his head better than me. And that seemed to be a lot of my career, some of these things happened just like that. I felt him reaching. I was trying to tell the 82, and Joe Ray will back this up, that, hey, we're in the water over here, can't get the engine started. This is a really bad situation. And this Jason Leonard reaches around me, and he pops my Siloam light. You know, we have these rescue lights, and he also started my emergency strobe, which I didn't think of. And I remember thinking, oh, that's smart. We should.
Right.
But he remembered.
What a good idea.
So now we're just outside the breakers. We're entering these tremendous waves that were coming up as they were, hitting the shore. All of a sudden, Jason goes into the water. And I'm, again, it was like my kids when they did something stupid. I'm yelling at them, "What? We're not on the beach yet, you know?" And, but thankfully, thank God, because God was watching out for us, the next huge wave picked up Jason in the water and me in the boat and deposited us way up on the beach. On Little Creek Beach, near the inlet where the Navy base is, and so now we're on the beach, and I'm standing. I got out of the small boat, and like you couldn't even see your feet. There was like foam. I don't know if you guys have ever seen anything like this, but it was like flowing sea foam. You couldn't see below your knees,
mm-hmm.
And we're in Mustangs. These aren't dry suits. There was no requirement for dry suits back then. I mean, it's freezing. My feet are freezing, and I'm thinking, crap, my boat's on the beach. That's really all I'm thinking about, and it's way up on the beach. And Jason says, again, the cook, he says, "Hey," "Hey, boats, they're down there." The sailboat had entered the, but they were fetched up further up because this is a big sailboat. And they were, the waves were just bashing one side of the sailboat and washing over it. But it was laying on its side up in the surf. And so we ran down the beach, and then we entered the surf again going out towards the sailboat. And then ultimately he carried the woman. I helped, I got that man's arm around me, and I helped him walk, get ashore. By then, EMS and, they're flashing lights, cops, everybody up there on the beach, and they took us all to the hospital and treated us for hypothermia. They actually put us in for a Coast Guard medal for that. And it was during the Admiral Yost days, and, I always told people, during those days, I think you really would have had to pretty much get killed get a Coast Guard medal in those days, because it got bumped all the way down to a Coast Guard Commendation Medal. But I felt good to get anything. I mean, we got some we didn't do that for recognition. In fact, and like I said, as in a lot of things in my career, I felt like I fell into it by accident without a lot of forethought. But the boat actually got a unit commendation. But it was a great case, and we saved those two people. I'm quite certain. I mean, it was cold, and they wouldn't have lasted long without us going out there and getting them. And anyway, it was an exciting time. I mean, I've been in and out of stuff. My old career, I could spend hours, and nobody really wants to hear it anymore. So no, I appreciate you guys.
That was an awesome.
One or two listeners out there.
No, I thought that was what an awesome case that kind of speaks to the character of the Coast Guard. You know, like our boat broke. We ended up on the beach. I'm cold and wet, but there's still two people that need us. So you go back out. That's it's incredible. Great case.
Master Chief was telling that story. All I could think of is, you know, that painting. It's in like every Coast Guard galley or on a base. It's the guys from Pea Island, carrying the kid out of the surf. Old school, like, you know, life-saving service type stuff there, Master Chief. That's a really cool story.
We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor.
We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT.
Well, they didn't give me any problems about the boat being on the beach. So we did spend the next... We had to get the station to help us get it up and... get it up on a trailer, and we got it out of there. But
maybe that's why the award got knocked down.
December 23rd, 1989. I remember that very well.
Solid Christmas gift to their family. But yeah, that's the difference between that Coast Guard and today's Coast Guard.
Right.
I think if you would add it on the beach, I don't know. I don't know what would happen.
Well, things that I go through in my book, and it was always a pet peeve of mine, certainly in the late 90s and early 2000s, there was a mindset in the Coast Guard that, hey, you know, we're doing all this risk management stuff, and, you know, like, you do remember we used to have green, amber, red, the GAR model for figuring out risk. And if you were in the red a lot of times, there was a lot of COs and OICs out there that just were, you know, paralyzed. They would use it as an excuse not to do anything. One of my leadership lessons in this book is about leadership and risk management. Because risk management was never meant to be something that it was to inform you and mitigate the risk. So risk management informs actions. It does not dictate actions. And that's a very strong leadership lesson, I think, for all of the Coast Guard during that time and to today's Coast Guards. Those guys go out. They go out in very risky conditions. I mean, I've seen some of the cases, because, you know, I'm very in touch with the Coast Guard. I work for Bollinger Shipyards. I do all these commissionings. I see what's happening out there. I'm very closely in touch with Jason Vanderhaden and the current Coast Guard leadership, Admiral Schultz. And, you know, I hear these things, and they are doing it well, and they're doing it safely. But I'll tell you, never use risk. I mean, if somebody's life is in danger, you got to try to mitigate the risk. And if there's no chance of everybody's going to die, I guess you shouldn't try to do it. But I was always against. I mean, I was a risk mitigator, certainly in my later career. You know, I learned the lessons early enough that you have to use thought. You can't just go into a situation half-cocked like the aforementioned two cases that I just talked about. Though on Point Arena, I mean, Mr. Ray, he did the right thing. We were doing the right thing by those people. We did. It would have been fine if we could have kept that boat run. But right, anyway, right. But you mitigate the risk. You just don't let it paralyze you.
Yeah, and I think, you know, to speak to that green, amber, red thing, I think the best thing that they've done since then was the, what's it called now, Peace,
the
right?
The Peace model, yeah.
But the best thing that's on there is a discussion on what's warranted, right? When do you take the risks? And it pretty much lays it out, like, here are the situations where you would, the risk is acceptable.
Right. Well, and we look at the risk versus the gain, not right. just the risk, right?
Yeah.
Like, and that's something I think, like Massachusetts said, we used to, there were people who would get paralyzed because it was too risky, but sometimes it's worth it.
Yeah, I like the fun meter.
Right.
You know, it's always fun meter? Yeah, it's always pegged. Always pegged.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Fun meters can be pegged, but I mean, one thing that I do talk about in the book is the case on the, I was also in charge of the Hammerhead. And
what was the Hammerhead, Master Chief? Was that an 87?
That was an 87.
Yep.
That was actually the second 87. It was the first one on the East Coast. And I talk about a story in the book. And there's a lot of, it's a more of a communication talk. I mean, the leadership, a lot of it comes back to communication, how you convey things to the crew. My early years, a lot of the leaders that I was around, all they did was scream. I used to think, if all you guys are going to do is stand there and scream, you know, what good are you? But I was determined not to be that way. So when I did raise my voice and hopefully give clear direction, the crew listened. But in this particular thing, this was off Georges Bank. It was in December. We were boarding a dragger. It was more or less, on an 82, would have been a routine boarding. I mean, it was a little rough. He's 4 to 6 feet, but not huge. A little windy, but not terrible, certainly not outside of our weather parameters for doing such a case. You know, we had the stern launch on an 87, so that made that very safe.
Right.
That was a 17-foot small boat. It was one of the first ones. It was built by Ambar, and I learned to hate that boat from this from this and a few other things that happened. But, you know, the boat crew went over. I think there was a seaman named Jovan Bielski, great guy. I think he's a police officer up in the Northeast now. And BM1 Andrea Curry, who retired as a warrant officer, she was a great XPO. And there was a MK2 on board named Kenny Yarborough, I remember, a great young man. There was a couple more, but they're going to be upset with me because I didn't say their name right now, but right at the moment. Anyway, so we launch. The boat goes over alongside this dragger, and you know they're alongside it. The boarding party goes to the bow of the Ambar, so that put all the weight in the bow of this 17-foot boat, and it was like a square-sided RHI. It had foam inside it. It wasn't just an air bladder, but that dragger rolled right with a wave, and when it did, it caught the chine on the Ambar and flipped it completely over, putting all four crew members in the water. BM1 Andrea Curry had some gear that was somehow got a hold of her and drug her somehow. Anyway, she ended up underneath the Ambar, inside it, okay? And her flotation, she was inside the air bubble in there. This is just a small boat. But she couldn't get out. Her flotation suit, which was a Mustang again. Again, we weren't using dry suits yet. It's really cold water now. You guys got to remember, even though the weather conditions aren't horrible, it's really cold water. So she's underneath the boat. Yarbrough and Bielski and someone else, I just can't remember their name right now. They're outside the boat. Andrea Curry reaches out with her feet, and Yarbrough feels it. And one of the seamen wanted to like swim to the 87, and Yarbrough told him, no, don't do that. Anyway, they reach down and they get Curry out, and now we got four heads by the overturned small boat, which was freaking me out, you know, because I could only see three.
Oh, yeah.
And the dragger had moved out of the way. Meanwhile, our spotlight chose that moment not to work. And man, we're trying to fix that. QM2 Eleni Sornig was on the bridge with it. Actually, she wrote a thing for the book that I included in the book. She says it was the only time she ever heard me curse. But I'm not sure what I cursed. But But I did know, I the crew had gone down below, the rest of the crew. And I told everybody on deck, we got a man overboard, you know. And, you know, when you got two choices, when you got people in the water, you know, a lot of the philosophy is to drift down on them, particularly with small boats. But I couldn't do that in this case because I would have been all over this RHI, and it would have probably screwed up the people as we were trying to get them up. So I had to come into the wind, and it chose that moment to kind of blow up a little bit. It was probably blowing 20 to 25. It was a brisk breeze. And, you know, we had those bag, you know, the lines that we used to throw.
Oh, yeah, like the rescue heaving lines.
Fist, but in 1989, they told us not to be using monkey's fist for something. I'm not quite sure. But we had these line-throwing bags. And that wind just blew it back, and I probably cursed again. But then I had to come back, reset, and get closer to them. And this time we did use – I had a couple of lines that were a monkey's fist. We used those and got them over.
As all good bosun mates do, Master Chief, as all good bosun mates do.
I didn't have no lines. We didn't use that ever again after this.
Right.
But we got all those guys up on the deck, and, I mean, they're throwing up. I mean, it was that cold. And while I was getting them on deck, that quickly, that small boat overturned, floated away. And, you know, we searched all night long for that thing and didn't find it till daybreak. And if any of those folks had, you know, like Curry was underneath it, if we'd have missed her and just pulled the three up, she'd have died for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, actually, several years later, it was funny. She sent me a picture of the dragger at the dock. I think it was the fishing vessel Liberty. And then she sent me this this poem by this guy named R.M. Snyder. And the poem goes like this. There are things about the sea which man can never know and never change. Those who describe the sea as angry or gentle or ferocious do not know the sea. The sea just doesn't know you're there. You take it as you find it, or it takes you, R.M. Snyder. And then she wrote on this card, remember always our mortality, BM1 Andrea Curry. Or no, it was BMC Andrea Curry at the time. I'm sitting here looking at it in my office. But I actually had it framed and put on my wall to always remind me, you know, how quickly what we think is routine can go south. The most routine things, we just had a Coast Guardsman, of course, up in Alaska, killed by a boom. I mean, these things can happen, and we have to really, really always be thinking about what's the worst that can happen and how can we mitigate it.
Yeah, what a powerful lesson.
Actually,
yeah.
I like kind of funny because I got that too. We the Hammerhead. I think there were three separate investigations over that. A brand new boat. So acquisition did an investigation. There was an AIM investigation, which was an administrative investigation by the district. There was a safety investigation, but I remember.
It's a lot cooler when they investigate your BM2 versus the OIC, I bet, huh?
No, that was the whole ship. I mean, was our training records correct?
Yeah, right.
Were we operating within parameters? I mean, we came out fine because all that was correct. I mean, we weren't doing anything that was that unusual. And the crew wasn't at fault either. I mean, sometimes things do happen. At any rate, we made it out and nobody got killed, and I learned some valuable lessons from him.
No one thinks
I had to
sure
tell Admiral Allen, I said, hey, all these investigations are going on, because that was my first Command Master Chief job coming off that boat. And he had already selected me, and I had to tell him, hey, this happened, and just letting you know, I got to get. Wait for the results for everybody to clear me. And but I was cleared, and it all went well.
Yeah, what a great story, man. Yeah. Great lessons, too. Thank you for that. Hey, I'd ask you real quick, what was your first SAR case in the Coast Guard?
Probably something on, I was on the Point Swift when I was first in. That was out of Clearwater, Florida. I got a good story on that, too. I don't know if it's in the book or not. That Master Chief, his name was Turpin, Harry Turpin. He was an amazing ship handler. Probably not the greatest communicator, but he was an amazing ship handler. But he, He used to put us over, you know, everybody uses a small boat to deliver people off the, any kind of coastal patrol boat or patrol craft. But he used to put us over bow to stern on almost everything we boarded. So we're down in the, this is, we'll call this a SAR case. We're down in the Dry Tortugas. It was a SAR case because the boat was taking on water. It was a concrete shrimper. It was that ferrous cement. It was a ship. It was a shrimper that was built out of that ferrous cement, which floated. And but it was concrete. I remember thinking, "Wow, concrete shrimper." But we got on board it, and I was new. I was like a seaman apprentice, and you know, the pump kept clogging up from crapping these caught people's bilges, and we had two or three pumps attempting to run them, and the boat's getting lower and lower in the water, and the seas are getting higher and higher, and we're off the Dry Tortugas. And finally, the Master Chief made the decision to pull us and the crew of this fishing vessel off. And, I mean, by the time we were doing this, I mean, the seas are really getting up. And he couldn't even use a small boat by then. And there was an MK2. I think his last name was Griffin. And he was a big, strong guy. Thank God he was there because I was like the last guy they were taking off. And, you know, you could only take one at a time on a bow to stern thing under those conditions, because you got to maneuver that 82 footer in close, and that bow, the 82 is going up and down and huge movements. And of course the shrimper, even though it was low in the water, I'm standing on kind of the stern of it and holding on to some rigging, but that thing's going up and down too. So I'm the last guy coming off, and that 82 footer bow came down really close to the shrimp boat. And Griffin, I can't remember his first name, but I did talk to him about this years later, but he grabbed me and pulled me. I was only about 130 pounds soaking wet. He pulled me right over that the lifelines up there on the bow of that 82. And then the next time the 82 went up, it came down hard on the kind of just underneath. There was like a sheer, and then it went up to a horizontal or a vertical for the last couple feet on an 82 footer bow, but it slammed into the stern of that shrimper. Didn't do much more than dent the 82, but I remember, man, I think I'm glad I wasn't in that spot.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, I had a pretty cool career from the standpoint of a lot of good sea stories. I don't tell them that often. Again, I go to things and I see a bunch of oldsters like me saying things, and you know, sometimes I see the young guys kind of just tuning them out, so I don't really get a chance to say much. So this is great. You just heard three or four stories.
No, we love it, Master Chief. Yeah, thank you.
They've been great stories too.
What so from your years in command, Master Chief, what do you think the most important lesson you took from them was, or what would you impart to people that are going to, you know, fill that role that you once filled?
First, it's an amazing role. People do not really understand it in the Coast Guard a lot of times. It's a position of great influence, and it can get a lot of great things done for Coast Guard people. When I was D7, I was just for instance, everybody knows you get, this will be a short one, 10 days house hunting leave, right?
Right.
When you go or administrative leave, when you're going to be transferred. Well, it used to be 5 days. And the chief's mess in Miami contacted me when I was a brand new D7 CMC. And then I contacted Vince Patton. He was the master chief of the Coast Guard. And I said, hey, these guys wrote up a really good justification. And I added a few things of myself. Then it to Vince, who took it to the chief of staff, Admiral Josiah at the time. And he was looking for things that he could just do a, quick hitter on, and made it law. And since then, everybody in the Coast Guard has gotten 10 days. And it's not just that. There's a zillion things the senior enlisted advisors of the Coast Guard can do for Coast Guard folks and for the Coast Guard commands that they're dealing with. I used to say that I could go to the highest person in the Coast Guard down to the lowliest seaman. A lot of times it was just a communication issue, maybe. And, you know, it was like a jumper wire. You know, those that do ATON understand this. Take a wire, you put it in one spot and one into another, you could jump it and make it work. And that's how a lot of times communication breaks down, and that's all it was. But I'll tell you, some amazing stuff. I could go on and on and up, but we're very short on time. Admiral Allen was the G7 commander down there. He taught me huge things about empowering his staff. I felt very empowered. So I knew him, and ultimately when I became the Master Chief of the Coast Guard with him, he empowered me to do stuff. And I feel like I was able to make a really positive impact because Admiral Allen empowered me. So empowerment, communication, all those things are lessons you learn that are really important to those command master chiefs.
Very cool.
Awesome.
Yeah. Well, Master Chief, I know you are short on time. Tell us again about the book and where we can find it.
Well, again, it'll be out in October. It's called Breaching the Summit. If you go to Casemate Publishers, it's CASEMATE. If you go to Casemate Publishing, and they're military publishers, and do a search for Breaching the Summit, I'm not sure, but very soon that should be able to be a pre-order. I'm quite certain that they're going to be pre-ordering.
It's definitely pre-ordered on Amazon because I already pre-ordered it. So, I mean, we'll see. But it's definitely, you can get it on Amazon too.
No, it sounds good, but it's there. I knew there was a few on Amazon from the previous publisher still, so I don't know if that's the same, but I think there's just a couple. But hopefully it's pre-ordering for Casemate, because that's going to be an excellent book. It's going to be hardback. These were all, the first run were all softback. These are going to be beautiful hardback editions, and only $30, which is, a deal for most of these military books. That, I've got some admiral that I know that I really like. He's a vice admiral retired for the Navy. His name is Barry Costello. He wrote a book called Fortune Favors Boldness. It was about the early days of Operation Iraqi Freedom and what the Naval and Coast Guard component did over there in the Northern Arabian Gulf. And, but man, that book set me back. I think it was like $45. I'm feeling blessed Casemate set a little lower price on our book.
Fair enough. And then where are you going to get any speaking engagements lined up for this thing, like where people could get it signed once it's out?
I think they are lining it. First, the big event is going to be at AUSA, the Association of the U.S. Army Exposition in October. But I've got some speaking events in between. I still got a couple of boxes of the paperback that I'm going to be using. I think that I'm going to come out to Petaluma. That's just in the early stages of being set up. I don't know exactly when, between now and sometime in the summer, and do the same leadership talk that I did in Yorktown. And hopefully that'll all go through. I'm in the early stages of talking to folks about that.
No, awesome, Master Chief. And if you ever do, whenever you get these things lined up, let us know. We'd love to come out and tell some more stories with you if you get a chance.
Yeah, sounds good.
Hey, awesome.
Well, hopefully I didn't bore the audience.
No, I'm sure guaranteed you did not. But
if they were bored, they tuned into the wrong podcast.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Hey, Vince Patton's got good sea stories too, but it's hard to make too much out of all those paper cuts that he got.
Oh, got it. That was good.
Well, hey, I love you, Ben.
Well, Master Chief, we really appreciate your time today. Wish you all the success with your book and your career in retirement. And thanks again for sharing your story and for your service to the country.
Yeah, thanks for your time, Master Chief. Really like the stories.
All right. Hey, take care now.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Another one to check out is the Always Ready Collective, which delivers art by and for some daring fighters of the sea. Head over to Etsy, Facebook, or Instagram and search Always Ready Collective to check out their Coast Guard and Maritime Focus tattoo flash,
pinups, and propaganda. You won't be disappointed. Anyone who gets one of their designs inked on their body will get featured on their feed and can be sent a care package on the house. Find a design you like, some blank canvas, and get it done. Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform. And like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.